I have a message from another time. Airy Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, The Order of the Rose, a Duelist Opera. Out of the Blue, by Benjamin D. Hutchins, hi, that's me, and Philip J. Moyer with Anne Cross. Friday, February 26th, 2410, 771 East Christie Avenue, New Avalon, Zeta Cygni. A brisk wind blowing in off Lake Daniels was lashing snow against the street windows of the three-story townhouse at 771 East Christie. In the front room, Caitlin Hutchins was curled up on a divan, a book of blank music staves propped up on one knee, doodling with a theme she'd had in mind when she woke up that morning. From time to time, whenever a particularly fierce gust of wind blew a particularly sharp-edged-sounding clutch of sleety snow against the window, she'd glance up and tut at the vileness of the weather. It was a good thing, she thought, that she didn't live far from Harkness Street High School. She believed in harsh condition training as much as the next Kenjutsu sensei, but making her student walk more than a block or two home from school in this mess would just be inhumane. As she thought this, the doorbell rang. Kate glanced at the grandfather clock in the corner of the room, but no, it wasn't even 2 in the afternoon. School wouldn't let out for more than an hour, and then there was a class meeting after that. Juniper wouldn't be home for hours yet. "I'll get it, Fritz," she called to the house's majordomo droid, putting aside her notebook and rising from the divan as she did so. She went to the hall, looked through the little panel of one-way glass in the front door, then made a surprised sound and yanked open the door.
"Utna!"
she exclaimed as her best friend and former roommate of many years ducked into the house and stomped snow from her boots.
"Hi, Kate,"
Utna Tenjo replied, shaking snow and ice pellets from her fedora before hanging it on a peg by the door.
"I don't know if you've noticed, but it's crappy out."
Kate shut the door behind Utna, waited for her to shrug out of her overcoat and hang it next to her hat, then gave her a hug and asked,
"What are you doing here?"
"I'm hiding," Utna replied matter-of-factly. Kate gave her a puzzled look.
"Hiding?"
Utna nodded grimly. "Hiding," she said, "from my wife, and my fiancé, and his mother, and her sister, all of whom seem bent on driving me batshit by the end of the week." She finished, throwing up her hands, a vaguely demented look creeping into her eyes.
"Come in and have a drink," Kate said after a moment.
A few minutes later, they were comfortably ensconced in the front room with mugs of Fritz's hot cocoa, which went a long way toward making Utna forget about her wet hair and generally disconcerted state. She stretched out on the sofa with her feet toward the crackling fire while her socks hung over the couch arm to dry, wriggled her toes, and sighed.
"So much better," she said, letting her head fall back onto the other arm of the couch.
With one hand, she held her mug of cocoa balanced on her flat stomach. With the other, she reached down beside her and played idly with the ears of Kate's pet tiger, Sergei, who lounged magnificently next to the sofa. Kate took a sip of her cocoa, set it down on the side table next to her divan, smiled mischievously, and asked,
"They're all driving you crazy?"
"God, you have no idea," Utna replied. "I was better off trying to do it all myself." 2 days earlier. Utna threw down her pencil in disgust.
"Ah, why did I ever agree to get married again?"
Enthi looked up from her book with a puzzled expression.
"Agree? Darling, it was your idea."
"Well, why didn't somebody stop me?" Utna asked rhetorically, shoving a hand back through her feathery pink hair.
"Why?"
Anthe inquired mildly, adding with a wry smile, "It worked out all right last time."
Last time, all I had to do was show up. Utina gestured feebly at the disordered array of papers and forms scattered before her on their dining room table. How the hell do I know how many shrimp cocktails we'll need? I'm not a freaking restaurant manager. Utina, the only thing stopping you from asking Vertandi's help this time is your pride, said Anthy with carefully restrained amusement. You know she'd have a fine time organizing her nephew's wedding. Utina rolled her eyes. Your sympathy is overwhelming, Himemia. I'm sympathetic, love, but I'm also practical. You're not having any fun with this. Why don't you ask someone who would? So I did, and I figured that'd be the end of it, but no. No, now it's 100 times more annoying, because I'm still doing just as much work, but now I have no control. At least when I was trying to do it all myself, I wasn't constantly getting pushed around and asked about things. Utina, what do you think of this cake design? Utina, you have to try this on. Utina, have you finished the invitation list yet? She made an exasperated gesture with her free hand, careful not to spill her cocoa, then went back to playing with Serge's ears. Well, Kate said diplomatically, it's nice that they want your input. Don't you believe it, Utina said with a dismissive wave. This is all them now. I'm just a prop in their stage show. I don't know how Corwin puts up with it. God. We should just run away to New Las Vegas and get married in the Thunder Force experience or something. With a soft sound, Caitlin patted her friend and former roommate's shoulder. You'll get through it, Utina, one way or another. You always have before. She gave her a one-armed hug so as not to disturb their respective cocoa mugs or Utrina's ministrations to Sergei. Yeah, I know, Utina admitted, tilting her head back to let her pink hair cascade over the end of the couch. That doesn't make it any less maddening to go through. A brief fey expression touched Kate's eyes. Well, if you like, I could call Marty and Aunt Eiko and they could shuttle you to New Las Vegas. Utina glanced sidelong at her friend. God, I'm almost tempted to take you up on that, Kate, she replied. But before she could give the matter her further attention, Serge's ears perked upward, swiveling toward the front hall. Eh? Caitlin's eyebrows went up at about the same time, and she started to get up from her seat. Funny, I wasn't expecting her home now. Huh? No, I'll get it, Kate, Utina replied as she got up instead, following Serge to the front door. Gives me something to do that isn't wedding-related. She was just about to look through the one-way pane of glass in the door to see who was out there when the door opened of its own accord, revealing a rather surprised-looking Juri Arisugawa, clad in a sleekly cut woolen overcoat, her cheeks pink with the cold from outside, the customary French curls in her orange hair partially uncoiled with a dusting of snow and ice pellets where her pillbox hat hadn't covered them. The two women looked at each other, each experiencing an uncanny moment of shared déjà vu. Utina was the one who spoke first. Juri? What are you doing here? Juri blinked, simply replied, I live here, Utina, before blinking again and going on, What are you doing here? Visiting Kate, and, hiding. Ah, Juri responded, still standing in the open doorway. She was just about to ask for further clarification when Serge somehow managed to work his way through one side of the doorway, prowl into the accumulating snow on the front steps, and shoulder the elder duelist into the house proper. After all, Juri Arisugawa and Utina Tenjo, while both fine human beings, were not Siberian tigers. Sometimes a life form just had to take matters into his own paws. The mild commotion at the front door commanded Kate's attention, and she entered the hallway just in time to see Juri and Utina, somewhat mildly entangled alongside the hall wall, as Serge nosed the door shut, cutting off the foul weather from outdoors. A small snowdrift had managed to enter in the interim, covering parts of the front rug, Jury and Utrina's footwear, and a briefcase and small paper sack that had fallen from Jury's hands as she had been escorted in. Caitlin's eyebrows went up, and she glanced at the two duelists with a quietly amused expression. Then she took in Jury's state a little more critically and titched. "Jury, dear, what are you doing home so early? You look a fright." She gently disentangled the two pinkening women, removed Jury's hat, and started to brush off the snow from her shoulders. Jury, looking uncommonly sheepish, at least to Utrina's eyes, replied, "Things were getting a little too rarefied at work today, and most of my day's major tasks were done, so I decided to come home before the afternoon commuter rush." "Why didn't you just have somebody fly you home, especially in this weather?" Utrina finally asked, now that they were separated and her short-term memory buffer was refilled with the salient details of Jury's current life state. "I thought you bigwig corporate types could do stuff like that," she continued with a slowly growing smile. "Well, yes," Jury admitted, before she coughed and shrugged off her overcoat, which Kate nimbly caught and hung on another wall peg. "But I took the N today. It didn't look that bad from the office window." Caitlin shook her head and made another tut-tutting sound. "Jury, your office is on the 180th floor. Of course the weather at street level didn't look too bad from up there. I'm surprised you could even see the street from up there today." She took Jury's hands and warmed them with her own. Even with the gloves that Jury had been wearing, the fingers were still cool to the touch. "Come on, sit by the fire and get yourself warmed up before you catch something." "All right," Jury replied, keeping hold of Kate's hands and being willingly led toward the front room, much to Utrina's amusement. She hesitated briefly at the threshold and tried to look over her shoulder. "I'm afraid that the turnovers I picked up at RGB got cold on the walk from Strange Fate Station." Utrina glanced back at the front hallway. "I don't think you'll have to worry about that, Jury." "Why is that?" "Serge seems to have eaten them." Kate and Jury turned to see Sergei's face just lifting out of the opened paper bag with an entire state building logo emblazoned on it. A smear of jelly was on the tip of his nose, which he expertly cleaned with a flick of his tongue. "Sergei!" Kate exclaimed, darting to the bag. Picking it up, she looked inside, then looked over her shoulder at Jury. "How many did you get?" 5, Jury replied. Kate gave Serge a scowl. "No treats for you tonight. You just had yours." Serge sighed. What was a tiger supposed to do when people left food lying around? Let it go to waste? And harrumphed back into the front room. Kate, trying her best to hide a smile, followed, handing the bag to Jury. To Jury's mild surprise, it still contained 4 pastries. "Well," Jury finally said, nonplussed, "I suppose I should have expected that." Utrina quirked a pink eyebrow, and then peered speculatively into the bag as well. "What kind of turnovers?" "Blue apple," Jury replied. Utrina got a twinkle in her eyes and took the bag from Jury with an indulgent smile. "Tell you what, Jury, you go into the front room and let Kate take care of you, and I'll be back in a few." "All right, Utrina, if you insist," Jury acquiesced, but with a smile that showed it was certainly no imposition. Humming to herself and feeling a touch lighter for the doing of it, Utrina headed to the kitchen. 10 minutes later, Utrina returned as promised. She carried a tray of reheated blue apple turnovers, each one now dusted with a light sheen of brown powder and accompanied with a small glass of blue-tinted cider. She smiled at the sight before her as she entered the room. Reclined along the length of the couch like some Greek goddess in repose was Jury, her head and shoulders being supported at one end by Caitlin, who was slowly drying and untangling her lover's hair with a hairbrush. All these years, Drury, and I've never figured out how the hell you've managed to get your hair up every single day in those curls of yours, Utna observed. Ancient Gaulish secret, Drury replied with an impish smile, which Kate returned. What she means is she has a staff of experts to help her every step of the way, Kate added with a wink. So I see. Utna grinned, set down the tray on the table next to the two women, and now took Kate's former place on the divan. Well, hey, dig in. They won't stay warm forever. Caitlin and Drury thanked Utna as they reached over to take the proffered turnovers. They each took a bite, and then their eyebrows went up in unison. Utna had to suppress a desire to snicker at the sight. This is not bad at all, Utna, Drury finally said with appreciation in her voice. The bakers at RGB are quite good, but you seem to have elevated their turnovers to another level. What did you do to them? Dusted them with nutmeg and cinnamon, Utna replied, sitting back on the divan with her own turnover on a napkin. I found out long ago it goes well with blue apples, brings out the flavor more. She lifted the pastry to her mouth to take a bite, but then stopped as she felt the furry weight of Sergei's head settle in her lap. Grrm, said the tiger, looking up at Utna and her turnover with bright tiger eyes. Nuh-uh, Utna gently admonished Serge with a tap on the nose. You didn't want to wait, so you don't get the special edition. Kate muffled a snicker, hiding an indulgent grin with her free hand, before directing her attention to her own turnover. The three women consumed their turnovers inside her in a companionable state, warmed by the library's fireplace and each other's company. They exchanged small talk, catching up with each other's lives as they relaxed, walled off from the rest of the world by the continuing snowstorm as much as the townhouse. Kate finished with her turnover first and resumed working on Jury's hair, drying and untangling the last of the gold-red locks before putting them into an approximation of their usual French curls. Jury didn't appear to mind that the effort was incomplete. She just smiled softly up at Caitlin before sitting up fully and favoring the composer with a quick, heartfelt kiss, getting a slight blush and kiss in return. How things change, Utna mused privately, watching the two of them. Time was, the two of them wouldn't even have hinted at making out where anybody might see them. And now? She shook her head in quiet wonderment and settled back in Kate's divan, one hand toying with Sergei's ears and fur, while the other took care of her warm drink. Drury finished eating the remains of her blue apple turnover, then cleaned off her fingers and lips with her napkin before folding it and setting it aside. Serge looked as if he was disappointed that the elegant redhead hadn't left any food remaining on her fingertips to clean off with his tongue, but otherwise didn't comment. Instead, he just continued to submit to Utrina's ministrations, patiently awaiting his next chance. Drury sipped more of her cider and looked thoughtfully at the two of them. Finally, she spoke up, addressing their guest. Utna, since you're here, may I ask your opinion of something? Utna directed a sidelong glance at Drury as she sipped her blue apple cider. Yeah, Drury, she replied with a quirked eyebrow, an expression more often seen on the older duelist than herself. Caitlin observed this with quiet bemusement before returning to the divan to pick up where she had left off with her earlier musical musings. This meant that Utna needed to move to the edge of the divan to continue sitting on it, but neither woman seemed to mind. Drury gazed into the bottom of her glass for a few seconds, then looked up again, regarding the pink-haired duelist. "I'm faced with something of a conundrum," she said, setting her glass aside and lacing her fingers together. "One of my first duties with Genom has been to revitalize a project which was not meeting its initial commitments and at risk of being re-awarded to another corporation. While I was successful at preventing this outcome, much to the chagrin of other companies, such as Frost Enterprises," Drury smiled briefly, then her expression turned serious once more, I now find myself faced with the fact that I'm a bit fuzzy on the particulars of aerospace fighters and the needs of their pilots. This is something of a handicap when one's company is developing a new starfighter for the IPO's Jedi Order. Utena blinked, sitting up straighter, clearly surprised by this news. "A specialized Jedi starfighter?" she inquired, blue eyes widening. Jury calmly nodded. "Mm-hmm. Which was why I thought of you when I considered this matter." She watched Utena for further reactions, though given the tomboy's hobbies and experiences, she wasn't too surprised that Utena was now giving her full attention as Jury continued her explanation. "Retaining the contract was a refreshing exercise of my business skills," she said with a wry grin, "and nicely affirmed all the effort I put into my degree, but neither that nor managing Kate's band has quite prepared me for understanding the needs of pilots and Jedi in space combat." Utena chuckled. "I've never noticed that my formal schooling has much of anything to do with my job either," she admitted as she set her cider glass aside. "Sure, I'd be glad to help. What do you need? I mean, presumably you've got engineers to handle the, you know, aeronautical aspects of the project, right? They're not expecting you to design the thing." Jury chuckled. "No, no," she said. "But as project manager, I'll be doing a lot of liaison work with the client, and it's important that I understand how they approach the task they'll be using our product for, insofar as I can. I thought you might recommend some suitable reading material that I can review on my own time," she added. Then said with a quirked smile, "I'm certain you'll add in your 2 credits as to what else I may need to consider." "All right, all right." Utena rolled her eyes, but smiled, conceding the point. Her expression then turned thoughtful as she tapped a knuckle against her teeth. "Books. Books. I've got some copies of my own of things Corwin and Dad have recommended, but they're all back on Tomodachi. But..." She got up off the edge of the divan and headed over to the book-laden shelves of the house's living room and adjoining library. "Some of that stuff got mixed in with Kate's books when she moved over here. At least I hope it did, because I can't find it anywhere at home." Jury looked curiously at Utena, then stood up and followed her to the shelves. Utena was now leaning over, rapidly checking the spines of the books that were available. "There was one in particular..." Utena continued checking, then made a satisfied sound as she came to a stop at one slim volume. "Oh good, it is here. Kosoe didn't abscond with it when she ran away to join the flying circus." She pulled the book from the shelf and stood up, turning around to present it. "Here, this should help, Jury. It's a good beginning primer." Jury accepted the book, glancing over the trade dress. There was something familiar about the style of the book, and when she looked at the cover and the title page, it became obvious where she had seen its kind before. "So you want to be a space cowboy. A guide to starfighter piloting. Lieutenant Derek Bacon, WDF. With Commander Benjamin Griffin Hutchins and Lieutenant Commander Maximilian Genius Sterling. Wedge Defense Force Press, 2089. Jury's eyebrows went up and she nodded in approval. "Yes, I think this should be very helpful," she replied, even as she reviewed the ad copy on the back of the book. Unbidden, a memory surfaced from the depths, and a fond smile crossed Jury's features. She remembered very well the first Bacon book she had read, which had coincidentally been the day she had first met Caitlin Hutchins. "Thank you, Utena," she finally added. "No prob," Utena answered offhandedly with a smile. "And, as for the Jedi angle..." She got another thoughtful expression and resumed studying the book spines on the shelves. "I know Dad has some scrolls and notebooks on the Asagiri Katsujin Kenryu's force aspects, but that's probably a bit too high order for your needs. You're not looking for instruction in manipulating the force, after all. Kate's got some stuff too, but again, a little bit overkill." Jury directed a brief glance at Caitlin, who looked up and shrugged, somewhat sheepishly, as if to say, "Well, if you'd told me, I'd have checked the shelves myself." Jerry smiled and nodded reassuringly, showing it wasn't a bother. Kate smiled back, relieved, and went back to her musical ponderings. Oh, here, this'll help lots. With a brisk, satisfied motion, Uchna pulled a somewhat thicker paperback volume out of the bookshelf. She held it over her shoulder, and Jerry took the book in her free hand. The taller duelist studied the cover as Uchna stood up and turned around. Myth-Busting the Jedi Order. Jamie Heineman, OJK. Jerry directed an arched eyebrow at Uchna. Now it was Uchna's turn to wear a sheepish look, as she provided an explanation. It was kind of a peace offering from Bastila, after she started working with Master Heineman at M5. She scratched the back of her head, then lowered her arm and looked down at the book. It's actually pretty good. If I'd read that before meeting her, we probably would have gotten off to a better start. Uchna paused and then went on, though she would have insisted I head to Alderaan right off anyway. She grinned. Ah, Jerry nodded. Well, I think these should get me started nicely. Thank you, Uchna. You're welcome, Uchna replied with a nod. And together, the two of them returned to the living room proper. Caitlin nodded in acknowledgement of their arrival, and then went back to her work. Her Neo-Tiger proceeded to the couch in order to receive scritches from whoever chose to sit there. As they settled down in their chosen seats, Jerry making herself comfortable in the room's armchair, Uchna back on the couch with Sergei, Uchna had a sudden thought. There had been something about the redhead's behavior that day that had been nagging at her, and it was only now that the realization had crystallized. One hand behind Serge's ears, Uchna turned her head to look at Jerry, who had already opened Derek Bacon's book. Hey, Jerry? Jerry paused briefly, having only reached the introduction, and glanced over at the younger woman. Hmm? Yes, Uchna? I've been here all afternoon, Uchna said, and then continued with a measure of surprise in her voice. And you haven't called me by my last name once. Jerry arched one slim tangerine eyebrow, regarding Uchna with her clear green eyes. Oh? I'm afraid I hadn't noticed, Tenjo. She smiled her little piper's smile and returned to reading. Uchna blinked and glanced over at the divan, her expression practically begging Caitlin for an explanation. Kate's reply was just a giggle and a fey twinkle in her brown eyes behind her glasses. Uchna rolled her eyes. Well, clearly she wasn't going to get an answer from that corner. With a mock put upon sigh, she focused her attention on Serge. At least he wouldn't be cryptic. When it came to things like food and scritches, Sergei was ever direct and to the point. The afternoon passed in a companionable quiet, aside from the sounds of the fire and Caitlin's occasional humming of a theme to test its modifications. The sound of stamping boots in the hallway announced the arrival of the youngest denizen of the house, and Anne's cheerful greeting to Fritz wafted down the hall. Hi, Fritz. Is that chili or burritos I smell? I'm starved. Good evening, Miss Anne. Fritz's German modulated voice replied. We will be having chili and corn tortillas for dinner this evening. Miss Caitlin is in the library with her guest and Miss Jury. Guest, huh? There was a pause, and then Anne's head and shoulders leaned around the doorway to the library, her cheeks bright red with exposure, and the hood of her winter jacket pushed back around her shoulders. Hi, Uchna. Are you staying for dinner? Wow, you look fried. If you guys don't mind, Uchna said, glancing at Caitlin. It is the perfect sort of day to sit by the fire and not go anywhere, Jerry observed, lowering her book. The weather is quite enough to keep any sane person indoors. Says the woman who walked by herself from Strange Fate Station to here while it was sleeting, Uchna commented in a stage whisper. Says the woman who came from Tomodachi to get away from it all, regardless of the weather, Jury rejoined, sotto voce. What a good thing I'm a Kenjutsu student, and therefore not sane, Anne observed, apparently ignoring Uchna and Jury's byplay. I'm going to go shovel the front walk, Sensei. It's shifted over to snowing proper, and I nearly killed myself on the ice underneath. The postman might not be so lucky. The mail's already come, and I don't think we're expecting anything else tonight, Anne, Caitlin observed. Yeah, but I don't want to have to break that crap up in the morning, and I'm already bundled up anyway. And we just spent the entire afternoon learning lots of different ways of making campfires, but Mr. Hellboy was quite firm that I not cheat, so I'm kind of wired. Anne vanished back around the doorway with a grin, and could be heard putting her boots back on. Caitlin laughed and wriggled back down into the divan, and Utina looked at her curiously. Campfires? She asked. Junie's going camping with a group from her school over spring break. Some of them haven't ever done survival training before, so they meet after school. I wonder how many different ways she learned to set things on fire today. You're letting her go? Utina asked. I mean, that seems like a prime opportunity for the Corps to try and snatch her if they find out about it. Aegis is pretty sure they've got agents in the sphere, even if they don't dare try anything in town. Hellboy's going along, Caitlin said. He's the faculty advisor for the Outing Club. Okay, never mind. Even the Corps isn't that dumb. Fritz entered with a tray to collect the various dishes that had accumulated on the end tables. Miss Caitlin, dinner should be served in about 20 minutes, the droid reported. Thank you, Fritz. The following day, Caitlin announced that she was holding Utina hostage and would only release her upon the successful conclusion of a diplomatic protocol requiring her to do no more than 1. Be available for 1-1 dress fitting, 2. Approve 1-1 cake design, and 3. Show up for the wedding 7 days hence. In response, Skuld announced that she was not in the habit of making deals with terrorists, and Caitlin could damn well keep her, a stance that was only moderated later that afternoon following the intervention of Beldandy. That evening, there was pie. It's traditional in some cultures to share pie upon the successful completion of a hostage negotiation, Caitlin explained. Miki Kaworo looked puzzled. What cultures? Well, my culture. Eat your pie, Caitlin commanded. Hey, it's really hard to argue with this cherry pie, guys, Juniper put in. It's so good it's distracting. Though technically released, Utina stayed in New Avalon for much of the next week anyway. It was, she explained, safer than going home. There was much less chance that one of the parties on the Tomodachi end of the deal would renege and drag her off to look at China patterns or some damn thing. Besides, she'd just have to come back the next weekend anyway. Besides, she was enjoying her visit too much to leave. It had only recently occurred to her how much she missed living with Kate. In the past, most of their separations had been temporary. Not until Kate moved back to New Avalon did it fully sink in for Utina that they really weren't housemates anymore. It was a surprisingly sobering realization, for all that it should have been obvious all along. She spent much of Thursday in a very reflective mood, considering the twists and turns in her life and Kate's that had brought them both to this point. Then she relaxed into the rhythms of Kate's household and just enjoyed this last stolen bit of time before she had to square off with her new life and find a new center point. Tuesday, March 2nd, 2410. Tenjo Academy, Sephiro. Mitsuru Tsuwabuki, president of the Tenjo Academy Student Council, was at his desk in the council office catching up on some paperwork when the elevator dinged and delivered a couple of his fellow Rose duelists. Keiko Sonoda, a senior and his vice president, and Carden Feltz, a fellow sophomore who held the office of secretary, looked worried about something. "Hi, guys," Tsuwabuki said. Then, noting their looks of concern, he asked, "What's the matter?" Feltz opened his mouth, then seemed to think better of speaking. He turned to Keiko, shrugging, and she thought about it for a moment herself before saying to Tsuwabuki, you should come see this. Suavaki regarded them both with puzzlement for a moment, then put down his pen. All right, he said, rising. He took his jeweled scimitar from the peg where it hung by its strap next to his desk, slung it across his back, and followed his comrades back into the elevator. Once out of the tower, they led him across the campus's sprawling central plaza, through the quad, and up the stairs to the secret forest's gate. What? He asked. Is someone trying to tamper with the forest again? I thought we'd taken care of that. Keiko shook her head. No, it's much weirder than that. Come on. So they entered the forest and mounted the spiraling staircase that led to the dueling platform above the clouds. They made the first part of the long climb in silence, but as they began to approach the platform, Fels said, Keiko and I decided to have a duel after class today. Keiko snorted. Fels wants me to do his history paper for him. Not happening. Fels smirked. Yeah, we'll see about that. Anyway, when we got to the platform, The trio rounded the last curve in the staircase and passed through the archway onto the dueling floor. We found that, Fels finished, pointing. Tsuwabuki blinked, unable at first to identify what he was seeing. At first he thought someone had dumped a heap of rags on the dueling floor, which would have been both inconsiderate and downright disrespectful, but none of his duelists would do a thing like that. With that possibility discarded, the shape resolved itself, and suddenly he realized that it was a person, mostly shrouded in tattered loose cloth, huddled face down near the edge of the platform. What in the... he murmured. That's what I said, Keiko agreed. And we figured, since you're the council president and the emergency backup mage and all, you should be the one to check it out, Fels went on. He raked a hand back through his brown hair where bits escaped from the queue he kept most of it in. Damnedest thing I ever saw. So Abaki walked across the platform and knelt next to the crumpled shape. Now that he was closer, he could see that it was a woman. Well, girl, really. From what little he could see of her build, she seemed about Keiko's age, with the most remarkable skin tone he'd ever seen. Her skin was black. Not dark brown, as the desert nomads of Shalhara were, but actually black, like the night sky or volcanic glass. Her hair was a dull charcoal gray color, long and wildly disordered as if by a stiff wind. She lay mostly face down, turned a little to the left, with one slim hand flung out before her. Tsuwabuki reached and placed his fingertips gently in the hollow of her wrist, searching for a pulse, and was pleased when he found one. Searching his mind for the appropriate magic, he sat back on his haunches and gathered his thoughts for a moment, then murmured a few ancient words and made subtle signs with his hands. A green glow surrounded the girl as he wove the spell around her. A little distance away, Keiko and Fels watched with awe. Tsuwabuki, apprentice to the Master Mage, was the only one of the current Sephiro duelists who could work outright sorcery, and they never tired of watching him do it. The magic informed its master that the girl, whoever she was seriously hurt. Bones broken, a concussion, injuries that almost seemed to suggest that she had fallen from a great height. Tsuwabuki deferred pondering that paradox, how does one fall to the highest place in the world, and delved deeper into the spell itself, commanding the forces within him to mend the damage within her. Magic was easiest to do up here on the platform, and it was the work of only a few shimmering moments to put right the worst of her hurts and deliver her from coma to simple sleep. That done, Tsuwabuki wiped a thin film of sweat from his forehead with his sleeve, reached a hand and gingerly rolled the unconscious girl onto her back. Her hair fell away, revealing her face, and he drew back in surprise. Her skin was so dark that the details of her face eluded the eye at first. She appeared almost as a living silhouette until his eyes became accustomed to looking for highlight instead of shadow to define her features. Then he could see that she had a sleek, delicate beauty about her. Though like the color of her skin, it was of a kind he'd never seen before. Too, against the darkness of her skin and her tattered robes, it took a moment for him to realize that she was streaked and spattered with blood. What really struck him, though, was the sight of her ears. They were pointed. He'd seen pointed ears before. One of the rune knights came from a planet called Hyrule, where everyone was possessed of truly impressive pointed ears, and these were similar. A little smaller, perhaps, and angled almost straight back, rather than upward, but definitely ears of a sort not found on anyone born in Sephiro. "Is she all right?" Fells asked. Tsuwabuki rose to his feet and walked slowly back toward his colleagues. "She will be," he said. "She was badly hurt, but I was able to mend her. She'll sleep for a few hours now." "Any idea who she is or where she came from?" Keiko asked, but Tsuwabuki shook his head and walked past, his face deeply pensive. He stood for a moment by the platform's opposite edge, gazing off into the blue sky, tapping at his chin with the ball of his thumb. Then he turned to Keiko and said, a little gruffly, "Clean her up and bring her to my tower," before striding through the archway and disappearing down the stairs without another word. Keiko felt proud of herself for not snorting out loud at the young sorcerer's statement, which she restrained herself from doing solely because he was obviously dead serious and very preoccupied. Instead, she turned to Feltz and asked, "Think you can get her down the stairs without killing yourself, Card? If you can get her to North Hall, I'll take it from there." Orifos. The Otori Institute, that gothic sprawl of black stone buildings at the center of the world, was not a school in the traditional sense. If anything in the brand new realm of Orifos could really be said to have traditional senses. Its students did study all the typical subjects, like history and literature, of the other planes, for the one they inhabited now had neither, mathematics and science, but they all knew that those topics were of secondary importance at best. They weren't here to learn to be stockbrokers or scribes or scientists. Students came to the Otori Institute to learn one thing and one thing only, the way of the duelist. As such, what happened in the classrooms was unimportant compared to what happened in the dueling chambers, and every student knew it. The school's administrators had gathered the best students they could find from all over the 10 worlds, brought them here and pitted them against the instructors and each other. Not the best and the brightest, for the brightest would be of little use to the Order of the Black Rose. No, say rather the best and the darkest. They came, seduced by the promise of power and glory, or driven by inner demons they could not tame. The reasons were unimportant. They came, and they fought, and sometimes they died. But those who triumphed grew, gaining strength, learning dedication, until the day when they were chosen to wear the Black Rose signet. Akio Otori stood and watched as a group of 10th-form students, very close to the point at which they would either succeed or wash out, performed weapon drills. Very few students, and none who had not already earned their signets, were considered strong or clever enough to specialize in unusual weapons. All of these wielded the Order's signature weapon, the single-handed dueling saber, every one forged cold from Muspel iron. They followed the orders of their dueling master precisely, never complaining, never deviating. They were almost ready. Almost perfect. Akio smiled coldly. Soon. Soon they would be ready. The largest of the iron bells in the Black Tower at the center of campus tolled. The students finished their drill, then fell into an orderly line to rack their weapons and bow to their instructor. With that done, they became something like normal students again, gathering up their things and chattering noisily among themselves as they left the room, bound for lunch. Akio left the shadows from which he had observed the class unnoticed and crossed the room toward the instructor, who stood with his arms folded, watching the last of the students leave. "They're impressive," he said. "You've done well, Mikage." Soji Mikage shook his head. "Impressive? Maybe a few," he said. "A handful of them have got the real fire. They may be able to do something. The rest are rabble. They learn the rote mechanics readily enough, but they'll never be proper duelists." He brushed imaginary lint from the sleeve of his black sorcerer's robe and fixed Akio with a baleful, bloodshot glare. "If you had to drag my shade screaming back from the abyss and bind me to your filthy service once more, Otori, you might at least give me decent materials to work with." Akio let the wizard's scorn roll off him, knowing it was meaningless. "As I recall," he said lightly, "you begged me to wrest you from the darkness and put you to use again." Mikage snorted. "As I recall, you said something about returning to Otori Academy so I could continue my work." "So it's in your best interest to do the best job for me you can. I'll need your students to take the place back, after all. Tell me about the ones you think have promise." "A handful, as I said, no more," Mikage said. "Probably the best of the lot is the girl Lena. She has spirit, and she's the most motivated student I have. Her humiliation at the hands of the Midgardian burns within her. She lusts for revenge against him and his kin." "Train her well, and she'll have her chance," Akio said. "And I? When do I get my chance?" Mikage's composure suddenly cracked, like a stressed mirror fracturing from side to side. Desperation sparked in his eyes as he added plaintively, "You promised me..." "Patience, Mikage," Akio said. "You'll have your chance. We just have to take the place back from its current occupants first." He smiled slyly. "I think you'll enjoy the new sorcery facility they've built. It's much more modern and better equipped than the one you burned down." Mikage's fists clenched. "You drove me to that," he hissed. Akio smiled coolly. "Justify it however you like," he said. Then, his voice and gaze hardening slightly, he added, "Just don't do it again." Mikage gathered his composure with a visible effort. "Is that all?" he asked, trying to seem brisk. "Surely you didn't come here simply to observe my students and drill and mock me." Akio's cool smile returned. "Indeed not. I came to inform you that I'm leaving the Institute for a few days, starting tomorrow. I have business to attend to. You will serve as acting headmaster while I'm away. I should be gone no more than a week." Mikage's dismay at this development was palpable. A week? A week responsible for the entire Institute? 5 days without Akio's direct rule as buffer between himself and the rest of the rabble at the top of the Order, those armored thugs from Midgard, the loathsome Venger, a week with the lives of all these students in his hands. Akio turned to go, then paused in the doorway, turned back, and said casually, "Do try to contain your instinct for arson this time around, Professor. It took my people a long time to recruit all these students. I really can't have you incinerating them." Then, with another thin smile, he left, saying as he went, "Good day, Mikage." Mikage stood next to his desk and watched the headmaster leave, then sank into his chair, trembling, eyes wild. Alone in his classroom, he buried his face in his hands and shook with grief. Though if anyone had asked him what for, he couldn't have said. Sephiro. Tsubaki was at his workbench when the elevator dinged and Keiko and Feltz arrived. "Here you go, boss," Keiko announced as Feltz carefully deposited their new find on the yellow leather sofa by the fireplace. All clean, but I decided to skip the fluff and fold. Figured you could take care of that yourself. Tsubaki shot her a, "Do you work here?" look, drawing a giggle as he crossed the room to have a look. "Thanks," he said. "You guys better clear out for now. She's liable to be pretty disoriented when she comes to, and having a crowd around isn't going to help any with that." "Well, okay, if you're sure," Feltz said, eyeing their guest dubiously. "Yeah, come on, Card," Keiko said breezily. "I'm sure the deputy chairman can handle any situation that might arise. Besides, seems to me you have a duel to lose." Feltz grinned. "Yeah, just keep telling yourself that," he said as they left. Tsubaki took down a book from one of his study's many bookshelves and sat down in an armchair opposite the sofa, contemplating its unconscious occupant. He saw that he'd been wrong about her hair. Now that Keiko had cleaned her up, it wasn't gray at all, but snow white, a perfect and vivid contrast to her coal-black skin. As she lay on the couch with her head propped on a throw pillow, he had her in profile, which accentuated the fineness of her features and the sharpness of her aquiline nose. She was... The only word Tsubaki could think of to describe her was alien, but in her way she was quite the fairest girl he had ever seen. He didn't find this distracting. Mitsuru Tsubaki had learned at an early age to function in the company of attractive females. Were it otherwise, he would never have survived joining the Otori Academy Student Council at the tender age of 10. Now, 4 years later, having studied for most of that time under Master Mage Clef, he felt almost like a grown man in a boy's fast-maturing body. He wondered if this had happened to Clef as well, and if that was why the Master Mage's power made him resemble the boy he must have been when he began his training. Well, no such thing would happen to Tsubaki. He was no academic sorcerer, relying solely on spells. He was a duelist, the captain of the Pillar's Guards. He couldn't do that job if he remained a child forever. Indeed, he half suspected he was growing as fast as he was because of his need to live up to his responsibilities. Shaking his head, he pushed that line of thought out of his mind. He'd pursued it several times before, even raised it with Master Clef, and received little but vague remarks in reply. The master could be maddeningly close-mouthed when it suited him. At any rate, right now Tsubaki had other things to worry about, like who this mysterious girl was, and how she came to be on the dueling platform. The book he'd selected was an Asgardian one, provided by Corwin Ravenhair's uncle Balder, Asgard's ambassador to Sephiro. It was a reference guide of sorts to the Nine Worlds, giving an overview of what one might expect to find when visiting each one. It was hardly comprehensive. The flora and fauna of Midgard alone could fill a whole library, but it was a decent starting point, and a book Tsubaki was very familiar with. He'd thumbed through it countless times since it arrived, fascinated by the diversity of form, custom, and culture to be found in the cosmos. It didn't take him long to find the page he wanted. The book practically fell open to it, so often had he paused at it in his reading. It was one of the many colored plates, printed on slightly coarser paper than the pages of text, and it depicted a typical inhabitant of one of the celestial realms. He was still looking at it and rereading the text on the facing page when the girl on the couch began to awaken. Closing the book on his finger, Tsubaki sat and watched with interest, but not alarm, as she stirred, shifting uneasily in her sleep. Then, half rising to a sitting position, she rubbed a forearm across her eyes, then opened them. Tsubaki had just enough time to notice that they were the most remarkable shade of pale blue, almost silver, before she shut them again with a hiss of pain and recoiled in alarm, putting her arm before her face again. "Ah!" she cried, her voice a little lower than he was expecting from so delicate-looking a girl. "Lakantha! Tansa Jakar!" "Hell, I should have expected this," Tsubaki chided himself. It was a beautiful day at Tencho Academy, the brilliant early spring sunshine reflecting from the blanket of melting snow that still covered much of the campus, and Suwabuki's chamber at the top of the white tower, with its windows all around, was flooded with light. "Dumak," he said, and darkness settled over the room as if the sun had suddenly gone down, though it was only a little past noon. In moments it was as if the brilliantly sunny day had become a moonlit night. The girl heard him speak, lowered her arm, and carefully opened one eye. It gleamed in the low silver light that was all that remained of the sunshine. She looked puzzled, then warily pleased, as she opened her other eye and regarded him curiously. "Natu varom?" she asked. Her curiosity turned to shock, then dismay, and then outrage, as Suwabuki darted across the space between them and suddenly, without warning or preamble, kissed her. And quite forcefully, too. He had quick reflexes, but hers were even quicker, and part of her instinctive slap connected as he ducked back and resumed his chair.
"Fool!" she snapped. "I don't know where you come from, but in my homeland that's not something people do when they've just met."
"My apologies," Suwabuki replied, thankful that the darkness in the room obscured the furious blush he felt on his face. It would only occur to him later that she could see it plainly anyway. The sage who wrote that spell must have had an abominable sense of humor. Why else would he have named it Meeting of Tongues? He sighed. Magic can be such a literal art. The girl blinked.
"Magic? You're a sorcerer?"
She tilted her head.
"But you're only a boy."
Suwabuki smiled, standing, and bowed to her.
"My name is Mitsuru Suwabuki. I am apprentice to Master Mage Clef, and I am at your service," he said.
Then, resuming his seat, he asked as non-threateningly as he could,
"How does a Svart Elf come to be in Sephiro?"
She blinked.
"Where?"
she said.
"Sephiro, the 10th world," Suwabuki elaborated. She gave him a baffled, skeptical look. "There are only 9 worlds."
"I'm afraid not," he said. "Sephiro is the 10th. It stands between your homeworld, Svartalfheim, and Midgard, the world of man. I'm surprised you haven't heard of it. It's been known of in the heavens for several years now, and we have had trouble with Svartalfen raiders before."
She hesitated. "I know little of worldly matters," she finally said.
She stopped suddenly, looking around as if startled by a sound or perhaps a memory.
"Wait," she said. "How can I... This can't be."
She got up from the chair and went to the window, but the view of the outside world was obscured by the shroud of darkness Suwabuki had called into being.
"Let me see what's outside," she said.
"I made it dark because the light hurt you," Suwabuki told her.
"I was surprised. I wasn't ready. I'll be all right now."
Turning to him, her expression pleading, she said,
"Please, please let me see where I am."
Suwabuki got up and crossed to her, giving her a thoughtful look. Standing, she was only a little taller than he was, though she looked several years older, and if she truly was a Svart Elf, that meant she was really decades older. "All right," he said. "Brace yourself." She nodded, turning to look outside, and Suwabuki said, "Shirok." In an instant, the darkness was gone. The girl hissed again, drawing back from the window and instinctively raising a hand. Suwabuki was about to call the shadows back down, but she waved him back and slowly, carefully looked outside, squinting against the light. To Suwabuki, the view from that side of the tower was an ordinary one, albeit beautiful. The eastern corner of the campus, the rolling, grassy hillside leading down to the town of Saito below, and the twinkling blue expanse of Saito Bay,
with its sailboats and two-masted ships. He saw it every day, and though he appreciated it, he couldn't say it took his breath away. The girl, on the other hand, once she could look at it at all, stood in awe, her ebon face slack with astonishment. It was obvious that the light still hurt her. As she gazed out at the day, her silver eyes watered, the tears trickling down her cheeks, and she clenched her fists in the folds of her tattered robes in obvious pain, but still she looked, as if transfixed by the mere sight of a sunny day. She looked for as long as she could stand it, then tore herself away and walked out of the light, back into the slightly shadier area in the middle of the room. She seemed to find this tolerable. "I have never heard of your world before," she said, "but I think I believe what you say. Surely it's nowhere I've ever been before, but how did I get here? How did you find me?" "I think that's a mystery we may have to tackle together," Suabaki said wryly. "What's your name?" She blinked, as if just realizing that she hadn't told him. Then, collecting her dignity, she made a slight obeisance to him and said, "Well met, mage's apprentice. My name is Anaximandra. I am the seventh daughter of Drax, third clan of the house of Wethringaroth." Then, looking ambivalent, she added, "Or at least I was. Now I am not much of anything." Suabaki went back to his chair and sat down, steepling his fingertips. "I think," he said as she returned to the couch, "you had better tell me about it."